and welcome to this hearing of the Rental Housing Commission. I'm Chairman Michael T. Spencer, and I'm joined by my colleague, Commissioner Diana Herseps. Today is June 20th, 2018, and the time is 11:03 a.m. We are convened in the Commission's hearing room, which is located at 441 4th Street, Northwest, Washington, D.C., Suite 1140BN. We are here pursuant to D.C. Law 610, the Rental Housing Act of 1985 as amended. This hearing, noticed at 11 a.m., is in regards to the housing accommodation located at 2774 11th Street, Northwest, Washington, D.C. The petition is numbered RHTP15303690. The case is styled SCF Management in Jefferson 11th Street LLC, Housing Providers Appellants versus 2724 11th Street Northwest Tenants Association Incorporated, Tenants Appellees. The Commission notes that there are parties seated before it and would ask you identify yourselves for the record, beginning with the Housing Providers Appellants.
Good morning, Your Honor. Kate Erklauer on behalf of the Housing Providers.
And which firm are you with?
Blumenthal and Cordone.
Thank you. And for the Tenants Appellees?
Good morning. Clayton LaForge of Latham & Watkins on behalf of the Tenants Association of 2724 11th Street.
Amanda Reeves of Latham & Watkins on behalf of the tenants as well.
Thank you. I would briefly like to explain the Commission's procedures. Our rules are similar to those of the D.C. Court of Appeals. Each party will have 20 minutes to present its case, beginning with the Housing Providers Appellants. The Housing Providers Appellants may preserve up to 5 minutes of its 20 minutes for rebuttal. Following the presentation of the tenant's appellee's case, the tenant must present all of its arguments within the 20-minute time frame and will have no rebuttal time. In its discretion, the Commission may allow additional time for argument to a party in the event that we engage in questions to occupy a substantial portion of that party's time. The Commission's decision will be issued in writing and sent to the parties. In this proceeding, the Commission does not request nor will it accept post-hearing submissions from either party. At this time, I will ask that you turn off any cell phones and other electronic equipment. I'll also like to correct a mistake I made earlier. When I said this hearing, the housing accommodation was located at 2774. I assume it's supposed to be 2724, so that was a typo on my part. The Commission has a pending motion for leave to file a reply brief filed on June 14th in opposition to that motion with the motion to strike the reply as filed. The Commission's rules, 3802.9, states there shall be no reply to a responsive brief, and the Commission shall not accept the brief if submitted. Accordingly, we are going to deny the Housing Providers Appellant's motion for leave to file a reply brief. At this time, the housing provider may begin his argument.
Good morning, and thank you. I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
I'd like to focus today on three issues and, of course, any questions that the commissioners have. The three issues that I'd like to address are, one, that the Office of Administrative Hearings erred as a matter of law in awarding damages for the period prior to April 17, 2017. Two, the Office of Administrative Hearings erred in awarding damages for mild and very mild conditions. And three, the Office of Administrative Hearings erred as a matter of law in awarding rent refunds for units 1, 8, and 5. To begin with, the time period for which the Office of Administrative Hearings awarded damages my argument is as follows. This petition was filed on July 2nd, 2015. The petition was filed by the firm of Latham & Watkins on behalf of the Tenants Association, who represented 15 units out of a 26-unit building. The tenant petition was detailed and requested relief for the period beginning April 17, 2015. In its brief, for the closing brief, for the first time, the tenants requested relief going back all the way to July 2012. They never sought leave to amend their petition. There's a body of law concerning the amendments to petitions and pleadings, as is encompassed by 1 DCMR 2929, and the tenants could have amended their pleading at any time prior to the conclusion of the hearing.
Counsel, are you familiar with the phrase de facto amendment?
Commissioner, no, I don't. I'm not familiar with that.
In the beginning of the hearing, with regard to the very first fact witness, who was the tenant from unit number 11, mm-hmm. maybe shortly after, close to around 1 p.m., there's a colloquy, and Ms. Blumenthal. There was an issue about whether the tenant petition would be admitted, and whether it was going to be admitted for. Take judicial notice, or you're going to crack it open. And in that phrase, in response to that issue, the housing provider opened the door by inquiring of the judge in response to a question of the tenant for clarification as to the time frame. So we've gone over the proceeding. And the very first time anyone actually references the phrase time frame was actually by the housing provider. And then there's a back and forth, and then the judge says, well, isn't it the time frame 3 years preceding the filing of the tenant petition? And then back and forth, and then it was established that was the 3 years. No further objections. Then, additionally, the other thing I want to inquire is, Ms. Blumenthal, initially when they started direct examination with this first witness, indicated an objection to surprise, that she was surprised that they were calling this fact witness out of turn. However, maybe 20 minutes later, when tenants' attorneys then actually start the actual direct in earnest of this witness, they begin by saying, with regard to the issue of the common area, for the time period of July 13 or 14, whatever it is, up until present, you know, what were the conditions of the building? No objection was drawn. And more importantly, in advance of that, Ms. Blumenthal interjected a form that they had received on May the 29th of 2015, which appears to have been an affirmative attempt by the housing providers to shrink the three-year period. And so we're kind of questioning why you're saying the very first time the issue of damages was brought up in the briefs at the end, when clearly in the first day, within the first 3 hours, it was completely brought to the attention and the housing providers never objected.
I understand your question, and I am familiar with that part of the proceeding. I believe what your question gets to is amendment by implicit consent, which again could have been brought up by the tenants if they sought to amend their petition at any time up to the close of evidence.
So you would not concede that that exchange within the first 3 hours, most importantly initiated by your co-counsel in direct communication with the judge, was not essentially an implicit amendment without any type of objection?
No, I would not concede that. And the reason for that is that the Tenants Association requested other relief, which would include treble damages and fines. And part of their case in chief includes establishing knowledge by the housing provider of conditions, the severity of those conditions, and the length of time that those conditions existed. Those factors could go towards the trebling of damages and to the awarding of fines, and evidence that those conditions existed prior to the time period explicitly contained in the tenant petition would be relevant to those conclusions that the ALJ could have made. Therefore, those issues were not an opposite to the claims that were actually raised in the complaint. And that's actually the standard that's articulated by the Court of Appeals in Moore versus Moore for amendment by implicit consent, is whether the admission of particular evidence went solely to the unpled issue alone, or it could have gone to issues that were contained in the petition themselves.
I understand that. However, it doesn't quite make any sense, if that were the case, why your co-counsel would have affirmatively interjected that form from May 29th of 2015, when her argument essentially was that this form shrinks the 3 years by a year, because her whole argument is that a year from May 29th, so you're knocking out all of 2014, and all I'm trying to say is that the idea that it was a surprise and you had no idea that the time frame, it makes no sense within the first 3 hours that she would then try to seek to have a stipulation with regard to this form, which, as she described, would allow the proceeding to go much more expediently.
To speak directly to that form, I believe what you're referring to is the proactive inspection that was issued by DCRA. And Ms. Blumenthal's intention with that was to establish that the housing provider, as of that date, was on notice that housing code violations did not exist in the premises. And it wasn't admitted for that purpose, but that was the argument that Ms. Blumenthal was making, was that that proactive inspection certification should be awarded the weight of putting the housing provider on notice that there were not housing code violations predating the date of that inspection, which again would go to the ALJ making a determination as to the severity of damages to notice and to trebling.
Just before you keep going, I just want to make sure that when this appeal initially started, there were 126 issues, and then in your brief, you broadly address essentially nine. It appears from our reading of your brief that the nine issues now encompasses all 126 claims of error. Do you have any comment with regard to that?
Yes, I do. The reason that there were 126 individual errors cited in the notice of appeal is that there were errors, for example, in the time period that the ALJ awarded damages for, and also in the standard applied by the Office of Administrative Hearing in the as to what is required for a substantial reduction in services and facilities. And because the Commission has historically been very particular about formalities, in order to reserve our rights as to challenge each of those individual findings, which were based on erroneous applications of the law, we cited each of those individual conclusions, which, as we briefed, all stem from misapplication of the law.
Thank you.
So to be clear, we are not, for the most part, challenging individual findings of fact, but rather the application of law to facts.
Thank you.
And this was not something that the commissioner addressed, but the basis that the Judge Pearson cited in her brief for being permitted to award damages for the period predating the time period sought in the petition, that being the period from July 2012 through April 2015, was that the tenant petition, it was not because of implied amendment, as the commissioner was saying, but her basis was instead that the petition sought other relief to which the tenants might be entitled. And it's our position that where the tenant petition was so detailed and specific as to what time period the tenants were requesting relief, that other relief to which they might be entitled applies only to issues such as trebling of damages and to civil fines. If the Commission doesn't have any additional questions onto this issue of the time period, I'd like to move on to the substantial. The Rental Housing Act allows a tenant association to petition for a rent refund based on a substantial reduction in services and facilities. The Act doesn't define what a substantial reduction in services and facilities is, but our Court of Appeals has adopted the definition for a substantial violation that is contained in the Act. Excuse me. That definition of substantial violation requires a condition that endangers or materially impairs the health or safety of tenants or occupants. In this case, the administrative law judge did not use that standard and instead relied on a provision of the regulations, and in her findings awarded rent refunds based on what she decided were substantial violations for conditions that she explicitly described as mild to very mild. Those conditions included things like a wobbly toilet, a watermark in the ceiling, interior doors which were sticking or difficult to open, things that she explicitly said were mild and very mild, and she didn't make any determination that those conditions, and I would say as a matter of fact, they do not arise to anything that is a condition that endangers or materially impairs the health or safety of tenants or occupants. When these, by my estimation, when you total these refunds that were awarded for these mild to very mild conditions, the petitioners received refunds in excess of $13,000.
So are you questioning essentially the application of 4216.2 with regard to substantiality as a matter of law, or are you arguing that the regulation is actually wrong?
I'm sorry, could you please read
4216.2, which talks about the violations are substantial or as a matter of law, or are you arguing that the regulation is essentially wrong? Because either she determined something was, as a matter of law, substantial, and then later, in order to come to the conclusion to value or to give a value or quantify it for the purposes of setting a damage award. And so we're just wondering whether you're juxtaposing the two things, because there's the question of whether something is substantial, and then there's a question of what value you give it. And it seems that perhaps you're kind of lumping the two together as opposed to a two-step process.
To respond to your question, the particular provision of 4216.2, I believe that the administrative law judge was relying on and which you're referring to, says that a large number of housing code violations, each of which may be either substantial or non-substantial, the aggregate of which is substantial because of the number of violations. And my argument with respect to that is that that regulation actually refers to substantial compliance with the housing code and not strictly to substantial violations. So I would say, for example, when a housing provider implements a rent increase, they cannot do so unless they meet the requirements of 4216.2. However, that's not the same as awarding a rent refund for a petition specifically based on a reduction in services and facilities. And were the OAH to apply this definition, I think that they could still not do so without first determining that all of those insubstantial violations in and of themselves were aggregated, endanger or materially impair the health and safety of a tenant or occupant. Commissioner, if you look at the list of A through T, those are things which on their face would impact health or safety, whereas unsubstantial ones do not, and therefore I believe there should have been a finding that they were a material threat to health or safety of a tenant or occupant. If the Commission doesn't have any additional questions on the issue of substantial violations in the award of rebates for mild or very mild conditions, I'd like to briefly turn to the issue of the award of damages for units 1, 5, and 8. As we briefed, the issue concerning units 1 and 8 is that the Office of Administrative Hearing explicitly found that there was insufficient evidence in the record to establish the rent level for those properties, and therefore there was no basis from which the ALJ could calculate a rent refund. Therefore, as a matter of law, it was improper to award a rent refund for those units. Going to the issue of the rent refund for Unit 5, as fully briefed, we take issue with the administrative law judge finding that Ms. Benitez was a tenant as a matter of law. but moreover, the final order awards the housing provider to award a rent refund to Mr. Escobar.
I just have one last question.
Yes.
Do you think with regard to, I think it was tenants exhibit, what is it, 145, the petition, do you think that that actually was in, what was the purpose for its admissions? What's your belief?
My belief as that was admitted for, excuse me, if I may have a
sure.
Water. My understanding of the admission of that exhibit was that it was not admitted for the fact of the matters asserted therein, and that it was only admitted for the purpose of notice. If it was sufficient, as tenants have argued, to establish rent levels, there would have been no need for a hearing on any of the matters that were raised at the hearing. It would have been sufficient to simply have arguments of counsel submitted through the tenant petition.
Do you think in the record somewhere, other than within, again, those first 3 hours of the proceeding where the whole back and forth over the purpose of admitting the petition was initially addressed and requested by tenants, that was revisited anywhere again?
No, I don't believe. I'm not familiar with any part
Thank
of the record.
You.
Thanks. We're going to go ahead and move to the tenant appellees. I'll come back to you later. Proceed, please.
Good morning, Chairman Spencer, Judge Harris Epps. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today. As the Commission is aware, this case arises from a July 2015 tenant petition filed by tenants from 15 units at 2724 11th Street Northwest. The bases, among several other alleged housing code violations, include rampant infestations of rodents, rats, pests, mice, bed bugs, some of which bit children, collapsed ceilings, allowing rainwater to flood into the building, mold throughout the apartment, and a lack of heat during the winter months, requiring some families to actually huddle in their living rooms. That was the basis, among many other alleged violations, for this tenant petition. Over the course of 16 days, Judge Erica Pearson held evidentiary hearings, weighing hundreds of exhibits provided by the tenants and the housing provider, as well as hearing testimony from approximately two dozen witnesses. Judge Pearson issued a meticulously detailed opinion and order, approximating 500 pages, going issue by issue, allegation by allegation, and unit by unit. In making the findings of fact and conclusions of law, Judge Pearson relied on experience with observing the testimony and observing the proffered witnesses. On appeal, the housing provider has discussed three specific issues. The first has to do with the sufficiency of the notice and the tenant petition. The tenant petition alone is sufficient to provide notice of the claims against the housing provider. But the bigger picture is that the housing provider knew before trial, at the outset of trial, and throughout the course of trial, that the relevant time period dated back 3 years to July of 2012.
So let me just lead in with the first last question I asked the housing provider. So when, again, within those first 3 hours, when one of your co-counsel then seeks to have your exhibit PX145 admitted into evidence during the direct examination of the tenant of Unit 11 with regard to setting the stage for the tenant association to have standing to represent the individual tenants for the purpose of this pleading, what's your interpretation of Judge Pearson admitting that document for judicial notice?
Our interpretation of that admission at that time is that it was not admitted, but it was eventually admitted later on in the trial. So PX145 was admitted for the content therein. But what's more is that the OAH is permitted to consider hearsay. So to the extent that Judge Pearson considered the evidence, it was admitted properly, but also she was entitled to do so under the OAH's rules.
Is there somewhere in the record you believe she articulates that although she indicated apparently very clearly during the colloquy with Ms. Blumenthal that the PX Exhibit 145 was admitted for judicial notice to take note that this was a document that was filed on behalf of the tenant association by the legal staff. At some point later, you believe she moves away from that and allows it to be cracked open?
In the final order, Judge Pearson cited PX 145 for a few propositions and factual supportive positions, but I don't have a specific citation for you right now, so I would ask the court to look at the final order for any citation of Plaintiff's Exhibit 145 to determine how the court relied on PX 145.
Well, if for example, going to Unit 5 or some of the other units, 1 or 8, some of the evidence that Judge Pearson relied on within the confines of that order, the only place that there's a reference is to the attachments to Exhibit 145, which is the petition. And unfortunately, it's unclear at this time whether those individual exhibits were actually ever admitted as individual exhibits. And there's one specific exhibit, which would be PX 193, which is the money order for the woman in Unit 5. Now, you had Exhibit PX 193 in your binder, and there's extensive direct examination with the tenant from Unit 5 with regard to PX 191 and 192, but not 193. And the only time that any testimony comes up about that money order, which would connect the link, was on cross of Stan Ford, and you don't make any reference to 193. You just go back and crack open the attachment to 145. And so my question to you is, there's various times where there's perfectly good evidence that the attachments to the petition, but it doesn't appear that the tenant's attorneys individually moved those exhibits in on their own merit.
The testimony itself that Judge Pearson credited was sufficient for the purpose of making a finding that there was a money order that the tenant provided. Additionally, the housing provider's brief effectively concedes as much. It concedes as much by stating that Ms. Benitez's name is on the money order. I'm not certain that there's a factual dispute. So although 193 may not have been admitted into evidence, there is sufficient testimony, and the housing provider's understanding that money orders were submitted should be sufficient.
Based on that same, with regard to unit number 8, I don't believe there is any testimony from the occupant of unit number 8 as to the actual amount of rent or any money orders, and that the only evidence that it appears that Judge Pearson drew from is some documents that flow out of the tenant petition, which I'm not hearing from you that the judge ever determined that she actually is going to use it for anything other than judicial notice.
Your Honor, we do believe that Judge Pearson accurately considered the tenant petition for its contents. And to reiterate, it's acceptable to consider hearsay evidence under the rules of the OAH. But what's more is that for Unit 8, the housing provider's own exhibit, 505V, is a letter dated July 25th, 2014, in which the housing provider wrote to the tenant in Unit 8 that the tenant's rent would remain at $823. But to address the general point here, it is correct that Judge Pearson made a factual finding in a footnote that she could not establish the exact dollar amount for the monthly rent for Unit 1. But that record evidence does exist in the form of these monthly rental agreements. The tenant paid $681 on a pro rata basis, and it was then bumped up to $875. It's disingenuous for the housing provider to say, we don't know what the rent is, and especially when it's proffered in the tenant petition right there. But what's more, Judge Pearson also demonstrated her intent to award damages and award refunds and found effectively that there was a sufficient range, a sufficient buffer.
I'm going to interrupt you. Do you note that there is a problem in the final order with regard to who exactly is awarded the damages, and notwithstanding the name of the individuals? At the end of the day, Judge Pearson, notwithstanding the tenant who testified with regard to Unit 5, the award was actually given to the name of the individual who actually is in a contractual relationship on paper with the housing provider.
Yes, Your Honor. That's a scrivener's error, a transcription error. Ms. Vanessa Benitez testified on behalf of her father, Magdaleno Benitez, for Unit 21. And the damages are clearly intended to be awarded to the Unit 21.
Very good.
Returning to the point briefly about the sufficiency of the record evidence for the tenants in Units 1 and 8, as noted, the housing provider's own exhibit, states the record evidence for the monthly rent paid by Unit 8. But for Unit 1, the bigger picture here is that Judge Pearson clearly made factual findings and legal conclusions that the tenant in Unit 1 is entitled to rent refunds and that there is a sufficient buffer between those damages awarded and the amount of rent that she paid.
How do you get around what seems to be a very basic question, is that one of the things you just kind of have to prove is the rent, like how much the rent was. I mean, that's a very simple question. There was clearly information within the record that potentially could have been asked, you know, that the tenants could have essentially proffered or confronted Stan Ford with the ledger of the rent ledger that presumably you would have received in discovery, because Ms. Blumenthal was using them right and left until, of course, those few units where no one asked the tenant about the rent. So my question to you is a very basic question. Do you think when they established the act and proceedings below or otherwise, that one of the basic things each proponent would have to do is establish the amount, the dollar amount of the rent demanded?
That makes sense. But what we can do here is look to the body of work that Judge Pearson did. She awarded damages to Unit 1, and in order for damages to be improper here, the tenant's monthly rent would actually need to be less than $200. So approximately $6,300 was awarded over the course of 36 months. That means that the tenant's rent here would need to be less than $200 a month. And that's simply not the case here.
But where, it's a very basic question, getting back to first year evidence, there's no evidence of the amount of rent.
The tenant's petitioner's exhibit 145, there is the operative lease that states expressly that there's a pro rata amount that the tenant will pay of $681 and then $875. The commission can affirm for any reason found in the record if it chooses to, but what's more is that the tenants would urge the commission, if it does determine that there needs to be an exact dollar amount in the record, to remand with instructions to make a limited factual finding. It's clear that Judge Pearson invested significant judicial resources in finding that the tenant in Unit 1 was entitled to damages. It's clear that Judge Pearson weighed the evidence and determined its credibility here. So for Judge Pearson to simply need to go back and make that very small factual finding would salvage significant judicial resources.
So I'm going to interrupt you again and ask you to think about Judge Pearson's, the way in which Judge Pearson discussed the issue of bad faith and the way in which she, it appears that rather than taking each of the individual units or claims, that she discussed it kind of all-encompassing as opposed to individually, and I would like your thoughts with regard to whether you thought that was proper, whether you thought that there was a need through the regulations or statutes or otherwise for her to have done to address the issue of bad faith for each and every tenant, maybe each unit, or each claim that she decide to trouble individually and then kind of parcel that out.
Right. Your Honor, the standard here does not require a seriatim or a piece-by-piece analysis of each alleged violation of bad faith. The requisite inquiry is there dishonest intent? Is there a heedless disregard of duty? And it's necessary to look to the significant discretion that we afford to an ALJ in those instances. As noted, the court sat through 16 days of evidentiary hearings and made factual findings that the housing provider offered altered photographs, lightened photographs. Several examples throughout the course of the final order demonstrate that there was disingenuousness. That's a quotation from the court. That the housing provider expressly failed on countless occasions to respond to the numerous requests, phone calls, and letters that the tenants made to request repairs. So going on an issue-by-issue basis is not required. And what's telling is that the housing provider cites for the commission neither law nor fact on that point. If they had a case, they would simply cite it. There's nothing that requires an ALJ to make that big of an inquiry. Rather, the necessary inquiry is dishonest intent and heedless disregard of duty.
Do you agree with the housing provider? It appears that there you may. In your brief, you cite to 4216.2U and this whole idea of aggregating insubstantial violations. you know, the commission would like to know your thoughts with regard to how the damage award, and do you believe that the judge actually did in fact aggregate them, or was that just, was that section in, was that reference to that section placed in your brief just in response to the arguments of the housing provider?
Judge Pearson, in the final order at pages 11 to 12, does a good job of reciting the state of the law. And frankly, the housing provider and the tenants are not far off in how they view the interpretation of this law. The housing provider relies on that quotation from Pareco, that there has to be a material or extreme danger to the health and safety of the tenants. But that's a non-exclusive factor. As you noted, Section 4216.2 does provide examples of what constitutes a substantial reduction of services. And it does so in a number of enumerated examples, and it also does so by saying that the court can look to non-substantial factors. And it's okay for the court to do that at the trial level. Several of this commission's cases that we cite in our brief, such as Bettis, Atchell, Karpinski, and Mitchell, all stand for that exact proposition. So although the housing provider is correct that Pareco provides one instructive form of how to get to a substantial reduction, it's not correct that's the only way to do an inquiry. But the housing provider's argument that the distinction between mild, medium, and severe classifications somehow bears on the substantial reduction of services misses the mark. And the reason for that is that Judge Pearson looked to the severity, the mild, the medium, the severe, in assessing damages. And I think you were intimating at this a little bit. The severity of damages, whether it's classified as mild, medium, or severe, goes to how much the award is going to be, not to whether, in the first instance, there's a substantial reduction. So the court necessarily has to find that there is a substantial reduction based either on aggregating the factors or finding that they are standing alone, substantial violations, and then it proceeds to the damages calculation. So it's a bit of a red herring to say, if it's mild, that doesn't mean that it's a substantial reduction. The court necessarily has to make that finding first.
You may proceed.
Okay. Returning briefly to the notice issue, the housing provider knew before, during, and throughout the course of the entire trial, as the commission noted, there was this discussion where the housing provider raised an objection stating that there is a relevant time period. The court then made an express finding that that relevant time period is 3 years. That alone should be sufficient to provide notice. But what's more is that over the course of 16 days, the housing provider heard evidence and indeed presented rebuttal evidence of alleged violations occurring throughout from July 2012 to the relevant time period.
So I'm going to interrupt you. So again, within that three-hour time period, although the tenants had established the time frame using taken from Ms. Blumenthal's statement, and although Ms. Blumenthal did not specifically object once you led with the time period, as you go down and you're trying to essentially move into evidence the letter that was written by the LADC from April 17th of 2015, there's an objection which is sustained because you're trying to move this letter in with regard to a notice. It's a letter that's written in English, and Ms. Blumenthal initially says, well, I'm going to object because there's no evidence in the record that the tenant from Unit 11 speaks English, and this letter is in English, and it's a detailed list of all the violations of everyone. So you're going back and forth, and you have it as the letter, the actual exhibit, which I want to say, I can't remember what exhibit is, but you actually are actually moving in that exhibit standing alone. When the tenants received pushback and an objection from Ms. Blumenthal with regard to that exhibit, the tenants immediately shift and say, oh, but Your Honor, and you turn to Ms. Blumenthal and say, will you stipulate that this letter was a part of the petition, that you had actually received part of the petition with regard to the issue of notice? That's the first instance where the tenants attempt to crack open the petition, which moments before had only been admitted into evidence for judicial notice, and that was not allowed. And so when you're balancing the idea that later Judge Pearson cracks open the petition and appropriately makes use of the petition and can make use of the petition because OAH can make use of these things. But there's instances in the record where your attempt to establish things was stopped when you would try to go in and affirmatively make use of something that was an attachment to the petition. And so I'm not sure how you come out with the idea that it was appropriate to draw and make actual evidentiary use of something that it appears that Judge Pearson had only admitted for judicial notice.
Well, again, the tenants would emphasize that hearsay is appropriate, and taking this for judicial notice is also an acceptable form for the court to make factual findings. There's nothing in the analog to Federal Rule of Evidence 201 that would prohibit the court from using a piece of evidence that it takes on judicial notice to support the propositions that are found in the contents of the exhibit. And furthermore, and what's telling is that the housing provider doesn't make that argument itself. It doesn't make the argument that PX 145 wasn't necessarily admitted, not for the truth of the matter asserted. There is discussion in the housing provider's brief that it should be limited to a certain role, but it doesn't go any further than stating that it was admitted for a, quote, limited purpose. There's no discussion there. And the housing provider would have discussed it had it had more.
Thank you. We're going to go back to the housing provider for your rebuttal.
Thank you. First, I would note that the tenants in their argument have provided no explanation as to why amendment of their petition wasn't required, as is provided in 1 DCMR 2929 before the conclusion of the hearing. That amendment would have been necessary in order to request the relief going back to July 2012. Second, the tenants suggest that there should be a remand for Judge Pearson to make additional findings as to the rent levels for units 1 and 8. It was the tenant's burden to establish that rent level during the proceeding. Judge Pearson has affirmatively found that there was insufficient evidence, and therefore it was an improper conclusion of law to find that an award could be made for those units.
So for unit H, she did determine what the rent level was, and so I thought what the tenants were saying is, if anything, remand it back for Judge Pearson to kind of parcel out how she came to the conclusion what the value was. Within the very first paragraph, her very first finding was the rent was for $800 or whatever the dollars was. So there's no footnote, there's no reference, and so they're not saying don't find, they're just saying send it back so she can clarify upon what evidence she relied on to render that. And you think that would be wrong?
I may have for unit 1, it was found that there was no rent. For unit 8, there is a conclusion that the rent was 800 some, but she doesn't cite any evidence for that proposition. So yes, I believe that would be improper to remand where there is no evidence that
with
is
with regard to unit 1.
For 1 and for 8, Commissioner, because they had their bite at the apple during their proceeding to establish evidence, and that was not established. With regard to Unit 5 and the establishment of the tenancy based on the payment of the money order, if the Commission is to accept that payment by the money order, I believe PX 193, that money order, which was paid in Ms. Benitez's own name, was only paid in July 2015. So that is sufficient only to establish a tenancy beginning July 2015, so it would be improper to award a refund for any period prior to that. And then with regards to the Commissioner's question about whether 4216.2U could establish a substantial reduction in services, the tenants have just argued that we should parse out the mild damages from mild conditions. And again, I would just say that OAH only should have awarded damages when there was a finding that those individual mild conditions were substantial, and the court did not do that. And I have nothing further.
Thank you.
Do you have anything anything else you wish to add?
I may have one moment,
Your Honor. Of course you can.
Thank you. One brief point, Your Honor. One point we wanted to emphasize is that at page 8 of the housing provider's brief, and as discussed here today, the housing provider notes that other forms of relief, such as trebling of damages and the imposition of civil fines, were appropriately explored during that 3-year relevant time period. That's an admission that the housing provider expressly makes. And it begs the question, where is the prejudice or the harm in any purported lack of notice? In other words, any error was harmless. There was no prejudice to the housing provider because the housing provider, by its own admission, says that it could have been asked to refute evidence of bad faith and willfulness in connection with treble damages prior to April 17, 2015. So in stating as much, what would be the difference between the evidence that it would proffer to support that there was no substantial reduction and what would be the evidence that it would proffer to support the fact that there was no bad faith? In other words, it knew and there was no harm and no prejudice.
Housing provider.
I would just respond that the Moore case specifically gets to this point and that the housing provider was deprived of its day in court because the tenants didn't make this amendment or seek to make an amendment at or before the conclusion of the hearing. That was always the housing provider's position that the tenants could explore those issues as it relates to particular issues and for other relief, but it was the tenant's burden to seek to move. And by failing to do so, the housing provider would be deprived of that day in court.
So notwithstanding the fact that it may have appeared to have initially been brought up on the very first day over a trial that started on February the 2nd and ended sometime, I don't know, was it April or May, over 4 months, that over that period of time with large gaps in between, it's still your position that there was no way to recoup that. It's not like it was 5 days or in 1 day. You had a long series, extensive evidence back and forth. I mean, there were even times where the housing provider specifically inquired of an employee from, Barack. I mean, there's this whole conversation between when the Barack company essentially acquiesced and Stan Ford stepped in. And then even that exchange back and forth kind of shift the blame with regard to the notice issue. You know, Stan Ford didn't receive notice. Actually, the Barack company received notice. That was all on Ms. Blumenthal, and all of that conversation happened within July of 2014. I mean, it begs the question as to why there was so much emphasis on the housing provider with regard to July of 2014, in the midst of this many-month hearing, and yet at the end you're saying you had no notice that they were going to seek damages any time before July of 2015.
If I could respond, going first to the what happened on that first day, it's important to remember that Ms. Blumenthal's objection to the question, which was, what has your experience generally been, Ms. Blumenthal made an objection because that was an improper question which lacked any time frame. And that objection was sustained, and the tenants' counsel was directed to limit the testimony so that we couldn't have irrelevant evidence. That doesn't mean that that specifically defined the period of relief for which the tenants were requesting when it was specifically stated in their petition, and the rules specifically provide that in order to request other relief, you make an amendment.
Thank you. At this time, I want to thank both parties, the housing provider as well as the tenant attorneys as well, for, I think, putting on a great representation for both of your clients. I particularly want to thank the tenant's attorneys because you are doing this pro bono. And as we know, it's very important for tenants, primarily in housing situations, to have counsel. And oftentimes they don't. So it's very admirable of your firm to contribute this time for sure. And I want to also acknowledge that we have a few housing advocates here today, as well as, most importantly, some tenants as well. I know you've taken time out of your busy schedules to be here. And the past 2 years, we've probably had this room full of people only once, one other time. So thank you for coming. The time is now 11:54 a.m. and this hearing is adjourned. Thank you all.